Chapter 6. Utmost preparedness to jump at the very first hint of some sort of order, but otherwise in a perfectly acquiescent state of mind. Suddenly, out of the companion, would appear a tall, dark figure, bareheaded, with a short white beard of a perpendicular cut, very visible in the dark captainess, disturbed in his reading down below by the frightful bounding and lurching of the ship. Leaning very much against the precipitous incline of the deck, he would take a turn or two, perfectly silent, hang on by the compass for a while, take another couple of turns, and suddenly burst out. "What are you trying to do with the ship?" And Mr. P, who was not good at catching what was shouted in the wind, would say interrogatively, "Yes, sir." Then in the increasing gale of the sea there would be a little private ship's storm going on in which you could detect strong language, pronounced in a tone of passion and exculpatory protestations uttered with every possible inflection of injured innocence. "By heavens, Mr. P. I used to carry on sail in my time, but, and the rest would be lost to me in a stormy gust of wind." Then, in a lull, P.S. protesting innocence would become audible. "She seems to stand it very well." And then another burst of an indignant voice. "Any fool can carry sail on a ship," and so on and so on, the ship meanwhile rushing on her way with a heavier list, a noisier splutter, a more threatening hiss of the white, almost blinding, sheet of foam to leeward. For the best of it was that Captain S. seemed constitutionally incapable of giving his officers a definite order to shorten sail, and so that extraordinarily vague row would go until at last it dawned upon them both, in some particularly alarming gust, that it was time to do something. There is nothing like the fearful inclination of your tall spars overloaded with canvas, to bring a deaf man and an angry one to their senses. Zia. So sail did get shortened more or less in time even in that ship, and her tall spars never went overboard, while I served in her. However, all the time I was with them, Captain S. and Mr. P. did not get on very well together. If P. carried on like the very devil, because he was too deaf to know how much wind there was, Captain S., who, as I have said, seemed constitutionally incapable of ordering one of his officers to shorten sail, resented the necessity forced upon him by Mr. P.'s desperate goings-on. It was in Captain S.'s tradition, rather, to reprove his officers for not carrying on quite enough in his phrase, or not taking every ounce of advantage of a fair wind. But there was also a psychological motive that made him extremely difficult to deal with on board that iron clipper. He had just come out of the Marvelous Tweed, a ship, I have heard, heavy to look at but of phenomenal speed. In the middle 60s as he had beaten by a day, and a half the steam mail boat from Hong Kong to Singapore. There was something peculiarly lucky, perhaps, in the placing of her masts, who knows? Officers of men of war used to come on board, to take the exact dimensions of her sail plan. Perhaps there had been a touch of genius, or the finger of good fortune in the fashioning of her lines at bow and stern. It is impossible to say. She was built in the East Indies somewhere, of teak wood throughout, except the deck. As he had a great sheer, high bows, and a clumsy stern. The men who had seen her described her to me as owing much to look at. But in the great Indian famine of the 70s that ship, already old then, made some wonderful dashes across the Gulf of Bengal with cargoes of rice from Rangoon to Madras. She took the secret of her speed with her, and, unsightly as she was, her image surely has its glorious place in the mirror of the old sea. The point, however, is that Captain S., who used to say frequently, "She never made a decent passage," after I left her, seemed to think that the secret of her speed lay in her famous commander. No doubt the secret of many a ship's excellence does lie with the man on board, but it was hopeless for Captain S. to try to make his new iron clipper equal the feats which made the old Tweed a name of praise upon the lips of English-speaking seamen. There was something pathetic in it, as in the endeavor of an artist in his old age, to equal the masterpieces of his youth, for the tweet's famous passages were Captain SS masterpieces. It was pathetic, and perhaps just the least bit dangerous. At any rate, I am glad that, what between Captain SS yearning for old triumphs and Mr. P.S. deafness, I have seen some memorable carrying on to make a passage. And I have carried on myself upon the tall spars of that Clyde shipbuilder's masterpiece as I have never carried on in a ship before or since. The second mate falling ill during the passage, I was promoted to officer of the watch, alone in charge of the deck. Thus the immense leverage of the ship's tall masts became a matter very near my own heart. I suppose it was something of a compliment for a young fellow to be trusted, apparently without any supervision, by such a commander as Captain S., though, as far as I can remember, neither the tone, nor the manner, nor yet the drift of Captain S.'s remarks addressed to myself did ever, by the most strained interpretation, imply a favorable opinion of my abilities. And he was, I must say, a most uncomfortable commander, to get your orders from at night. If I had the watch from 8 till midnight, he would leave the deck about 9 with the words, "Don't take any sail off her." Then, on the point of disappearing down the companionway, he would add curtly, "Aunt carry anything away." I am glad to say that I never did. One night, however, I was caught, not quite prepared, by a sudden shift of wind. There was, of course, a good deal of noise running about, the shouts of the sailors, the thrashing of the sails enough, in fact, to wake the dead. But S never came on deck. When I was relieved by the chief mate an hour afterwards, he sent for me. I went into his stateroom. He was lying on his couch wrapped up in a rug, with a pillow under his head. "What was the matter with you up there just now?" he asked. "Wind flew round on the lee quarter, sir," I said. "Couldn't you see the ship coming?" "Yes, sir, I thought it wasn't very far off." "Why didn't you have your courses hauled up at once, then?" he asked in a tone that ought to have made my blood run cold. But this was my chance, and I did not let it slip. "Well, sir," I said in an apologetic tone, "she was going 11 knots very nicely, and I thought she would do for another half hour or so." He gazed at me darkly out of his head, lying very still on the white pillow, for a time. "Ah, yes, another half hour. That's the way ships get dismasted." And that was all I got in the way of a wigging. I waited a little while, and then went out, shutting carefully the door of the stateroom after me. Well, I have loved, lived with, and left the sea without ever seeing a ship's tall fabric of sticks, cobwebs and gossamer go by the board. Sheer good luck, no doubt. But as to poor P., I am sure that he would not have got off scot-free like this, but for the god of gales, who called him away early from this earth, which is three parts ocean, and therefore a fit abode for sailors. A few years afterwards I met in an Indian port a man who had served in the ships of the same company. Names came up in our talk, names of our colleagues, in the same employ, and, naturally enough, I asked after P. Had he got a command yet? And the other man answered carelessly, "No, but he's provided for, anyhow. A heavy sea took him off the poop in the run between New Zealand and the Horn." Thus P passed away from amongst the tall spars of ships that he had tried to their utmost in many a spell of boisterous weather. He had shown me what carrying on meant, but he was not a man to learn discretion from. He could not help his deafness. One can only remember his cheery temper, his admiration for the jokes in Punch, his little oddities like his strange passion for borrowing looking glasses, for instance. Each of our cabins had its own looking glass screwed to the bulkhead, and what he wanted with more of them, we never could fathom. He asked for the loan in confidential tones. Why? Mystery. We made various surmises. No one will ever know now. At any rate, it was a harmless eccentricity, and may the god of gales, who took him away so abruptly between New Zealand and the Horn, let his soul rest in some paradise of true seamen, where no amount of carrying on will ever dismast a ship. Zee. There has been a time when a ship's chief mate, pocketbook in hand and pencil behind his ear, kept one eye aloft upon his riggers, and the other down the hatchway on the stevedores, and watched the disposition of his ship's cargo, knowing that even before she started he was already doing his best to secure for her an easy and quick passage. The hurry of the times, the loading and discharging organization of the docks, the use of hoisting machinery which works quickly and will not wait, the cry for prompt dispatch, the very size of his ship, stand nowadays between the modern seaman and the thorough knowledge of his craft. There are profitable ships and unprofitable ships. The profitable ship will carry a large load through all the hazards of the weather, and, when at rest, will stand up in dock and shift from berth to berth without ballast. There is a point of perfection in a ship as a worker, when she is spoken of as being able to sail without ballast. I have never met that sort of paragon myself, but I have seen these paragons advertised amongst ships for sale. Such excess of virtue and good nature on the part of a ship always provoked my mistrust. It is open to any man to say that his ship will sail without ballast, and he will say it too, with every mark of profound conviction, especially if he is not going to sail in her himself. The risk of advertising her as able to sail without ballast is not great, since the statement does not imply a warranty of her arriving anywhere. Moreover, it is strictly true that most ships will sail without ballast for some little time before they turn turtle upon the crew. A shipowner loves a profitable ship. The seaman is proud of her. A doubt of her good looks seldom exists in his mind. But if he can boast of her more useful qualities, it is an added satisfaction for his self-love. The loading of ships was once a matter of skill, judgment, and knowledge. Thick books have been written about it. Stevens on Stowage is a portly volume with the renown and weight in its own world of Coke on Littleton. Stevens is an agreeable writer, and, as is the case with men of talent, his gifts adorn his sterling soundness. He gives you the official teaching on the whole subject, is precise as to rules, mentions illustrative events, quotes law cases where verdicts turned upon a point of stowage. He is never pedantic, and, for all his close adherence to broad principles, he is ready to admit that no two ships can be treated exactly alike. Stevedoring, which had been a skilled labor, is fast becoming a labor without the skill. The modern steamship with her many holds is not loaded within the sailor-like meaning of the word. She is filled up. Her cargo is not stowed in any sense. It is simply dumped into her through six hatchways, more or less, by 12 winches or so, with clatter and hurry and racket and heat, in a cloud of steam and a mess of coal dust. As long as you keep her propeller underwater and take care, say, not to fling down barrels of oil on top of bales of silk, or deposit an iron bridge girder of 5 ton or so upon a bed of coffee bags, you have done about all in the way of duty that the cry for prompt dispatch will allow you to do. Ziv. The sailing ship, when I knew her in her days of perfection, was a sensible creature. When I say her days of perfection, I mean perfection of build, gear, seaworthy qualities and case of handling, not the perfection of speed. That quality has departed with the change of building material. No iron ship of yesterday ever attained the marvels of speed which the seamanship of men famous in their time had obtained from their wooden, copper-sheeted predecessors. Everything had been done to make the iron ship perfect, but no wit of man had managed to devise an efficient coating composition to keep her bottom clean with the smooth cleanness of yellow metal sheeting. After a spell of a few weeks at sea, an iron ship begins to lag, as if she had grown tired too soon. It is only her bottom that is getting foul. A very little affects the speed of an iron ship which is not driven on by a merciless propeller. Often it is impossible to tell what inconsiderate trifle puts her off her stride. A certain mysteriousness hangs around the quality of speed as it was displayed by the old sailing ships commanded by a competent seaman. In those days the speed depended upon the seaman, Therefore, apart from the laws, rules, and regulations for the good preservation of his cargo, he was careful of his loading, or what is technically called the trim of his ship. Some ships sailed fast on an even keel, others had to be trimmed quite 1 foot by the stern, and I have heard of a ship that gave her best speed on a wind when so loaded as to float a couple of inches by the head. I call to mind a winter landscape in Amsterdam, a flat foreground of waste land, with here and there stacks of timber, like the huts of a camp of some very miserable tribe, the long stretch of the Handelsgade, cold, stone-faced quays, with the snow-sprinkled ground and the hard, frozen water of the canal, in which were set ships one behind another with their frosty mooring ropes hanging slack, and their decks idle and deserted. Because, as the master stevedore, a gentle, pale person, with a few golden hairs on his chin, and a reddened nose, informed me, their cargoes were frozen in up country on barges and shites. In the distance, beyond the waste ground, and running parallel with the line of ships, a line of brown, warm-toned houses seemed bowed under snow-laden roofs. From afar at the end of Tsar Peterstraat, issued in the frosty air the tinkle of bells of the horse tramkers, appearing and disappearing in the opening between the buildings, like little toy carriages harnessed with toy horses and played with by people that appeared no bigger than children. I was, as the French say, biting my fists with impatience for that cargo frozen up country, with rage at that canal set fast, at the wintry and deserted aspect of all those ships that seemed to decay. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.